from the Moen Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. California is taking things to the next level, as in stage two of the state's stay-at-home order. Friday, some retail stores, such as florists and sporting goods, can reopen for pickup with restrictions. Now, with that in the works, we'll hear where the LA Unified School District stands. A plan has been laid down to keep kids caught up and ready for when they can eventually get back in the classroom. It's all ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. I'm Amy Martinez. It's Monday. Thanks for joining us. Really busy today, so let's get right to it. Governor Gavin Newsom says California will enter reopening phase two this Friday. Now, guidelines on how to exactly do that will be coming from his office on Thursday.
As early as the end of this week, you will have the capacity as a retailer with the modifications and the guidelines we set forth on Thursday to begin to reopen for pickup clothing, bookstores, music, toys, sporting goods stores, florists with Mother's Day coming up.
Toys and sporting goods. Gotta love that. He said all businesses will have to meet local health and safety guidelines and will allow counties to decide what to do about restaurants. And in case you're wondering, when asked about this, LA County's public health director just said officials are, quote, looking at it this week. We'll get the response from Orange County a little later in the show. Now, speaking of reopening, let's start today off by talking about schools. LA Unified School District head Austin Buettner laid out a plan today to keep children educated, caught up, and ready for the fall school year. Here to bring us all the details, we have KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes. Welcome back, Kyle.
Hiya.
Now, we haven't finished with this school year, but already we know that next school year is still slated to start August 18th. What's known about how that could work?
Not a whole lot. That is basically that date that you mentioned, A, is really the sum total of the announcement that Buettner made today, was that basically the fall semester's initially scheduled start date is still on. But there are a lot of questions that basically Buettner said in an interview with me as well, that things are just too early to say whether that's going to be an in-person discussion, whether students are going to be in classrooms, whether it's going to continue distance learning through that time, whether there's going to be some combination of both of those things. It's still too early to say. Why is it still too early to say? Because of the same, you know, conditions that the governor has outlined. It's not clear to Buettner that there is enough contact tracing and coronavirus testing available, enough personal protective gear available. And there are so many unanswered questions about, even if those public health conditions were in place, what schools would look like even if they were to reopen in-person instruction right now.
Just wondering if Buettner gave any indication of what they might be looking for, maybe to figure out when campus can open, like an if this, then that kind of scenario.
Like, he's been very clear about the need for coronavirus testing and contact tracing. It's those types of conditions. Okay. And he basically said that they are looking at a lot of the same things that the governor is looking at. But I will say that what the governor had said last week was that it might be possible for schools. He's sort of exploring the suggestion that schools might open their new school year early on July, you know, sometime in mid-July, perhaps, in an effort to try and combat learning loss. And it was notable today that the governor, even in announcing the beginning of this phase two reopening, initially, you know, there was some discussion that schools might be part of that phase two. But looking over the transcript of today's Newsom press conference, I don't see any reference to schools at all. So it is noticeable that maybe the school aspect of this might take a little bit longer to resume in-person instruction.
So let's just say classes can resume in person at some point. Have they talked about maybe what that might look like maybe a limited class size or something like that?
Yeah, it's going to have to involve some sort of maintenance of social distancing. A lot of people agree that that's going to be the case, but how you do that is still very much up in the air. And when I asked Buettner about that, he didn't, said that the district is exploring the answers in LAUSD, what are the options that are available, but that it's way too early to say what that is exactly going to look like. But it's probably going to be some version of staggered schedules or students attending in-person in-person classes on one day and then alternating to distance learning the next day, something like that. There's still a lot of questions about how you do lunch, recess, assemblies, all of those kinds of things. And that's all being worked out. And it's not just an LAUSD question. There are districts all over the state of California trying to figure out how that's going to work.
What about online summer classes? I know that he wants to get students caught up for lost learning. Any idea how that's going to look like?
Yeah, this was another big part that I think this date discussion is kind of suppressing. The district is really trying to scale up its summer learning options this year. And normally, the summer school has been limited to just the highest need students, you know, students who need to make up credits they might have missed during the normal course of the year. Well, Buettner announced today that they're going to open up two other summer programs for students who are not necessarily far behind, just for any student. Both, you know, enrichment opportunities. He teased this sort of, you know, opportunity with like Fender guitars to teach kids guitar lessons. And then in addition, some actual core classroom instruction. One, you know, document I've seen says it's going to be 2 hours per day of for students in all grade levels of core instruction in reading and English language arts and math, excuse me. And that will be open to all students and will start in mid-June. So the opportunity for students to maybe make sure that if they weren't able to fully engage during the course of this normal semester, but in the course of the regularly scheduled semester, they might get a chance to make it up over the summer.
How is LAUSD going to pay for a summer school to make that happen?
Yeah, still a big question. I talked with the superintendent, and he says that the funding LAUSD gets for its existing summer school program comes with some strings attached, and those strings really mean that only the highest need students can participate. Here's what he said when I talked to him.
The constraint in summer school in the past has been budget, not desire or interest. It's been budget. The state doesn't provide additional funding for it. In these extraordinary circumstances, we are going to make it available for all because we think gaps in learning are problematic for students.
But the result is going to be that the district could end up, you know, exceeding its normal summer school budget by something like $50 million. And so significant amount of money that basically Buettner has said that perhaps the state could pay for, maybe the federal government might be able to come through with a stimulus. But it's one of those other issues that he has said so many times for other topics as well. This is something that we just have to do, and we have to figure out how to pay for it later, but provide the service now because kids need it. And that's been his MO throughout the crisis.
One more thing, Kyle. I know a lot of students aren't able to take advantage of online learning right now for a lot of different reasons. So what's the expectation for students and parents for summer if they're having trouble making it work now?
Yeah, the participation in summer school is going to be voluntary, you know, and that goes even for students who might be needing to make up additional credits and coursework, just like it is every year. Summer school is not necessarily mandatory. Obviously, students who need the credits have to figure out some way to earn the credits. But I mean, you mentioned that there are just these gaps that have existed, and an amount of like not levelness. It's been uneven, the access that students have had to their distance learning. I got an email just today from a parent who said that they haven't received a laptop and they've been trying to get a laptop for many days. I should say the district says most families in high school and about three quarters of the families in elementary schools do have laptops. But I think that even just that is one little indication that even if you do have a laptop, whether students are engaged in this work is still a huge question. And there's concern that students just aren't able to engage with it in the same way as they would if they were in the classroom.
That's KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes. Kyle, as always, thanks a lot.
You bet.
All right, though, we're getting some good news about allowing some businesses to reopen soon. The number of people diagnosed with COVID-19 in LA County continues to climb. We now have a total of 26,217 cases of COVID-19, with the addition of 568 new cases announced today. Now, with that in mind, let's hear from someone who has been on the front lines of this pandemic since March, helping patients during their most critical moments. Lindsay Burrell is a registered nurse in the intensive care unit at Little Company of Mary Medical Center in Torrance. She saw her first COVID-19 patient on March 17th and shared with us her experience so far.
I will never forget the first time that I walked into a COVID patient's room. I was extremely anxious. I was physically shaking, thinking, okay, this is it. Like, this is what I've prepared for. You'd walk through our ICU before, and you would see family in and out of patients' rooms. Nurses would be walking in and out of patients' rooms just trying to brighten someone's day. But now you have patients isolated in a room by themselves, completely away from the normal world. And some of them are dying, and they're dying alone, with the exception of just us as healthcare providers. Their families aren't around. Instead of them being at their bedside, I'm FaceTiming them and I'm Zooming them as they take their last breath, and it is devastating. You really need to be methodical about what you're going to do when you walk into a patient's room, because we are having to cluster care in an effort to decrease our risk of being exposed. I have a 4-year-old and a 20-month-old who need me more than anyone. And I feared every shift that I went to work that what if I brought COVID home with me and didn't know it, and I exposed my kids and my husband to this? We kind of feel like we're working on a battlefield and you just hope that you come out unscathed. But the fact of the matter is there is a chance that we will go home and we will have exposed ourselves to COVID. There is no guarantee. And with myself, 3 years ago, I had open heart surgery for a valve. And for the first time since then, I'm actually more nervous about getting COVID, because I realize that maybe this could affect me like some of my patients. The levels of anxiety really took a toll on a lot of us. And with myself, I will be the first to say that the anxiety and the nerves were really wreaking havoc on my body. I wasn't sleeping. I wasn't eating. I couldn't think straight. I felt like I was only a shell of myself walking through the intensive care. And never have I felt this before. And I have been faced with a lot of challenges as a nurse, but never like this. And I reached out to a psychiatrist and a therapist, because I knew that there was no way that I could treat a patient if I myself wasn't healthy inside. I asked questions of my administration multiple times. What is our plan? What will we do? And I got the answers that I needed. That we had an overflow plan. We had a staffing plan. Travelers were being hired. You know, I knew that no matter what, I would be protected, that our administration wanted to protect us no matter how bad this virus was. And that is absolutely necessary to have. And in the midst of a nationwide shortage of PPE currently, I feel very fortunate that never once was I ever denied a mask or any type of PPE. I will speak for myself. It was key in the success of this. California's numbers are what they are right now because we reacted quickly, because we had a plan, just like my hospital did, a week ahead of time, so that when this hit in California, we could beat it. Our numbers prove that. Our social distancing and staying at home has been instrumental in decreasing our numbers from what we once thought they were going to be. And I urge everyone, listen, stay home. Wait for it to be safe for us to go out slowly. Think.
That was Lindsay Burrell, an ICU nurse at Little Company of Mary Medical Center in Torrance, California. It has not been easy adjusting to all of the different ways the pandemic has changed our lives. Sheltering in place can be a drag for some, but also a psychological backbreaker for others. And it doesn't help for us here in California when we see other states last week easing some of their restrictions. There are ways to cope, though. There are ways, mechanisms that can actually help you avoid scratching the itch to ditch physical distancing. That's coming up next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and also streaming on kpcc.org. I'm E. Martinez. One of the things we keep hearing that's needed for the state to truly reopen is, one, an increase in testing, and two, a better ability to track who has the disease and who does not. Now, to that second part, Governor Gavin Newsom today also announced a collaboration with UCLA and UC San Francisco aimed at training people to trace coronavirus in their own communities. He hopes to recruit 10,000 so-called disease detectives in the coming weeks. Now, as we enter another week of the stay-at-home order, folks are wrestling with many issues, such as finding work, making rent, isolation, and, for essential workers, workplace anxiety. We've talked to many medical experts on the program about the science and data behind this pandemic, but now we're going to take some time to talk about mental health and also self-care. Nataria Joseph is a clinical health psychologist at Pepperdine University. Welcome back to Take Two.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, and sure. Thanks for having this important conversation.
It's critically important, right? Because a lot of us have been stuck at home and not seeing family and friends for a long, long time now, going on 7 weeks almost now. Now, the idea for this also got kicked off from this question that we received from one of our listeners, and it's, quote, "I think we all intellectually understand the need to stay home, but the news of, one, flattening the curve, and two, other states and counties beginning to formally lift restrictions give people the itch. I'd love to hear from medical psychological experts about how to reinforce our resolve while also providing coping mechanisms to deal with the psychological toll of staying isolated." Now, Nataria, we've heard the governor today say that things are going to start to reopen soon, but that won't necessarily apply everywhere. So how do you advise we get through the next few weeks, and how can folks strengthen that resolve to stay at home and stay the course?
That's actually a really great question. And I think whenever we think about a solution to an issue, we have to think about what's the source of the problem. And so a lot of people are finding social distancing to be very difficult for a number of reasons. One, the primary reason for a lot of people is that they actually achieve their sense of identity through their social relationships, through the people in which they connect to, through the group that they belong to. And so for a lot of individuals, they're finding themselves feeling a lack of a sense of self. Like, who am I if I'm not this person that's connected through these relationships, or if I'm not a member of this particular group? And so that's one of the primary reasons why it's very, very difficult for people to resist the temptation to defy the best practices. And so one thing to keep in mind when we think about how can we better cope with social distancing is to think about the fact that a lot of us are waking up on a daily basis with just an amorphous cloud of negative emotions hanging over our head. People are just waking up and feeling badly or feeling negatively, and they don't quite know the source of that. And so psychological research suggests that identifying the source of that emotion, as well as labeling that emotion, is a very simple but also very powerful tool by which to begin to cope with those emotions.
Wondering, you mentioned how a lot of people have this realization that who am I if I'm not part of this group, and in terms of these social bonds that aren't there right now because we have to be away from each other. How much of that, Natalia, is a lack of self-esteem, for lack of a better way to explain it, in that, look, I'm a human being that has value, and that value is not predicated on the group I associate with or the friends I hang out with?
It's another great question. And actually, social identity theorists actually theorize that all of us, to some degree, achieve our identity through our social groups and through our social relationships. And as you've alluded to, there's a huge degree of individual differences in terms of the extent to which someone achieves their identity through their social group memberships. So there's a wide kind of variety or continuum of those individual differences. But I think, as you are kind of alluding to as well, there's other ways for people to achieve their identity. And so there's very quick, again, simple yet powerful tools by which we can engage in a process called self-affirmation, which involves, simply put, just addressing what our values are, what our purpose is, what our sense of vocation is in this lifetime. And those are other ways by which we can achieve our identity and strengthen our sense of self.
Now, then there's the idea of perceived social isolation and how that might affect people. Can you tell us how people may be experiencing that?
Absolutely. So in terms of the perception versus objective measurements, right, when we study social isolation, we study the number of connections that a person has. But then in terms of the perception, in terms of loneliness, it's more so of a mindset, a feeling, a lack of companionship, for example. And so that's how we differentiate between those two states of mind. And in terms of dealing with loneliness, there's a lot of solutions that we can bring to bear in coping with this. One thing we want to keep in mind is healthy use of social media. So during times like these, social media can actually be detrimental on some fronts, because we can actually experience vicarious trauma through being exposed to a lot of really horrific stories about loss of life and threats to life that others are experiencing. And even if we don't ourselves experience it, that vicarious trauma can actually impact us psychologically as well as physiologically. And so it's important for all of us to keep that in mind and try to mitigate our exposure to that vicarious trauma. But then at the same time, we can also use social media in a more positive way by actually trying to establish deeper connections. So not just passively scrolling or looking at people's profiles, but actually establishing connections, making meaningful comments on other people's posts, sending meaningful messages to others as well. So it's those deep connections that could help people who are both alone and lonely as well.
Natalia, some might argue that simply logging onto social media is an unhealthy way to use the internet. I mean, it's that deep for some people, but I'm glad you said healthy use of the internet, because yeah, there is a difference between healthy and unhealthy. We're talking to Natalia Joseph, a clinical health psychologist at Pepperdine University. Now, overwhelmingly, the questions that we're getting right now or about rent relief and unemployment. And here's the thing. It's hard to practice self-care when so many basic survival necessities are threatened for a lot of people. So for those that are going through this very tough time, how do you advise that they take care of themselves at the same time?
Understood. So there's a few different things that I would suggest, one of which comes from this idea of kind of achieving a mindset of collectivism. So in the US, in LA in particular as well, a lot of times we have a more individualistic mindset. However, taking on more of a collective mindset could be really helpful during this time. So in other words, people can exchange services and favors with each other. People can compile resources. An individual who's at risk of losing their job can offer their expertise and their skills in the service of others. And it's possible that that could lead to them getting a new job later if they do lose their job. And so I guess my kind of main theme here is trying to find ways in which we don't feel ashamed by our personal now financial circumstances and actually put those in the table on the table. Put our strengths, our skills, our expertise in the service of others, and eventually that could lead to better outcomes for all involved, including the individual as well.
Wow, that's so difficult though, right? Not being ashamed of where you find yourself. I mean, a lot of people find ourselves in the same situation, yet that shame does exist, and that can be really, really terrible. Now, while adults are also struggling with isolation, kids are feeling the effects as well. One anonymous listener wrote, and Natari, I'm telling you, this could be me asking it because I had this conversation with my granddaughter last week. But here's the quote from our anonymous listener. My 4-year-old granddaughter doesn't understand why I can't pick her up and bring her to my house like I've been doing. How do I explain to her why? It hurts to hear her crying because she doesn't understand and I don't know how to tell her. So what can parents say to young children about the situation that doesn't cause extra stress to kids?
So here's where an understanding of developmental life stages could really be brought to bear. So when it comes to kids, it's interesting that kids are actually extremely resilient. And there's a number of things that we can do as adults in order to cultivate that resiliency. So number one key is to validate their emotions, right? To help them feel that they're secure and safe in expressing themselves with us. In terms of kids, as long as we approach them with warmth, it can really go a long way. And I would also suggest keeping the explanation as simple as possible. So when it comes to kids, I think that they understand rules, right? They understand that there's rules on the playground, there's rules in the classroom or at school, etc. And so for an adult that's trying to explain to a young child why they can't do certain previous behaviors, I think keeping it simple and saying, you know, there's this new rule, you know how you have rules on the playground or rules in school. As adults, we have these new rules that I'm being asked to follow right now, and to just explain it through that particular lens, because kids can kind of understand rules separate right from wrong, and they understand that. And I think also giving as many reinforcements, rewards, positive attention as possible to kids is very important. And another thing that we often overlook with kids is giving them some power in the situation, giving them some say in decisions, right? So possibly asking them, you know, this rule that's currently kind of preventing us from being able to do these things, as soon as this rule is over, what would you like to do? Them draw or create a vision board of what they'd like to do as soon as the rule is over, or even as the rule is continuing play a role in their lives, what are other things that they'd like to do in the meantime as well? So I think giving them a say in decisions and just approaching them with warmth and validation and simplicity will go a long way.
I got to remember that, because last week when I was having that conversation with my granddaughter, my youngest granddaughter, she's 5. Part of it was trying to hold it together when we're having this FaceTime phone call so that she wouldn't see me just crying up a storm. But I like what you said. Yeah, giving her the power to say, what would you like to do when this is over? Now, one more question. Another anonymous listener wrote this. My potty trained 3-year-old grandson had just started preschool and loved it. He asks his mom every day if he can go to school and even says he will run away. Now he is having bedwetting accidents. And anecdotally, we've heard similar things from parents about stomach aches, sleeping issues, nightmares occurring in recent weeks. Is there a potential connection here between this new behavior and the current situation? What advice would you give parents on how to figure this out?
There's definitely possibly a connection. When we think about kids as well as adults, it's possible that these uncertain times are causing just this free-floating sense of anxiety. Again, where in particular for kids, a lack of consistency, a lack of routine can really bring about pre-existing anxiety amongst kids. And so one main thing that I would advise is to try to incorporate consistency as much as possible. In this particular example, you discussed a kid who really liked preschool. And so obviously, again, because of these rules, as we would explain it to the child, they can't go to preschool itself. However, how do we break this down into its most essential units? So in other words, what does this child like about preschool? is there a way that we can simulate those basic elements that he or she likes about preschool, but do it in the home environment? How can we replicate all of the child's likes and preferences from preschool and actually incorporate them in the home environment and do so in a consistent way?
We need to have you for an hour. Natarya Joseph is a clinical health psychologist at Pepperdine University. Natarya, thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you.
All right, you may be aware already, but in case you're not, may the 4th be with you. It is May 4th, the day Star Wars fans in this galaxy, and even in ones that are far, far away, celebrate all things related to the franchise. Considering it's the 47th day of the stay-at-home order, we thought we'd offer up a little Jedi wisdom as our mid-show moment of zen. For people that feel they can't take isolation any longer and that the scope of the coronavirus pandemic is just too big to handle, we want to remind you of that scene in The Empire Strikes Back when Master Yoda is training Luke Skywalker to use the Force to pull the X-Wing fighter out of the water, and Luke, after failing to do so, complains that it's just too big. Yoda then drops some knowledge and Zen all at the same time.
Size matters not. Look at me. Just me by my size, do you? And where you should not. For my ally is the Force. And a powerful ally it is. Life creates it. Makes it grow. Its energy surrounds us. And binds us. Luminous beings are we, not this crude matter. You must feel the Force around you. Here. Between you. Me. The tree. The rock. Everywhere. Yes. Even between the land and the ship.
Yoda then shows Luke how it's done by dragging it out himself using the Force. In that spirit, through this, we will get, and in this, we are together. And may the 4th be with you. All right, at the end of last week, there was a lot of tension in Orange County. Governor Newsom was not happy that folks headed out to the shore. And then there were protesters in Huntington Beach, surfers in Newport, which led to Newsom saying he was closing Orange County's beaches. We'll hear where things stand today in the battle over staying in or staying out on the sand. That's next when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and also the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. All eyes are on Orange County. After the governor told officials there to close down all the beaches last week, there's been some pretty loud opposition. And on Friday, one city there, Huntington Beach, was the site of a pretty big, large protest. Now, for an update on what's going on, we're joined by Nick Gerda. He's a reporter with a nonprofit news site, The Voice of OC, joins us most Mondays. Hello, Nick.
Hey, great to be here.
All right. So there was a lot going on this afternoon. So let's start with the latest. Earlier today, we heard Gavin Newsom say that we could enter what he's called phase two of reopening the state as early as Friday. And that means small retail stores such as bookstores, florists, sporting goods, toy stores that might reopen, but that he'll extend decision making to local government. So what might this mean for Orange County?
Exactly. The governor was talking about opening up into the beginning phases of phase two, essentially, that there may be more openings down the line. But at first, perhaps bookstores and clothing stores being able to do curbside pickup. That's what he's talking about potentially later this week. There's a bit of confusion right now in Orange County about which closure orders are being enforced and how. Some OC officials are saying they won't be enforcing certain aspects of the governor's order. So in different counties and different communities across the state, there's kind of different interpretations and approaches going on. Orange County officials have been really emphasizing they want to see a reopening of businesses as long as they follow social distancing and other guidelines. So still a lot to be sorted out in terms of what will reopen and when and coming announcements in the next few days.
So on the issue of the beach, I understand that some cities are now submitting plans to the governor for how they'd reopen beaches safely. So what's happening with that?
That's right. The governor said last week that he wants to work with cities and the county on reopening the beaches. Obviously, it caused a lot of controversy in Orange County and a lot of pushback on him when he did specify just Orange County would have those beach closures. And over the weekend, some of the cities sent their plans to the state. One of the ways they're proposing to reopen is with what San Clemente did, which is called active recreation only. So essentially exercising, walking, jogging, running, things like that would be okay as long as people socially distance. And yeah, so several cities have been proposing that. The state apparently gave its approval today to two cities, Laguna Beach and San Clemente, to reopen their beaches with certain limits.
So let's talk about Laguna Beach's plan. What is their plan, and why did officials get the green light?
Yeah, so their plan is to reopen their beaches on weekdays only from 6 a.m. to 10 a.m., with people allowed to exercise but not congregate in groups. So that's jogging, walking, swimming, and surfing would be allowed, but sunbathing and congregating in groups would not be allowed. They essentially were, I think, trying to thread the needle and satisfy what the governor said his intent was, not having large groups of people gathering while still giving people an opportunity to enjoy the sunshine and get some exercise and get a break from being indoors.
Jogging and walking could involve sunbathing, too. You're just doing it while you're moving.
Exactly.
The same but different, right? Yeah. Yeah. All right. Now, meanwhile, news just crossed that Newport Beach City Councilman Kevin Muldoon has filed a federal lawsuit against the state to reopen Orange County's beaches. What do we know about what prompted this and where this might end up?
Yeah, it's the latest in a series of legal challenges from Orange County to the governor's beach closure order. The first series of challenges was brought on Friday by the cities of Huntington Beach and Dana Point, as well as a former vice chair of the California Republican Party, Harmeet Dillon. And now Kevin Muldoon, the Newport councilman, has thrown his hat in the ring and filed this federal lawsuit against the state. The arguments in court so far have been that the governor is allegedly violating constitutional rights like freedom to travel, freedom of assembly, by shutting down the beaches specifically in Orange County, while the state's lawyers have said the governor is protecting public health and has the authority to do so under state law, the Emergency Services Act. The first test of those lawsuits came on Friday afternoon, just hours after the first round of suits were filed. The cities and Dillon asked the judge in Orange County Superior Court to issue an order blocking Newsom's beach closures in Orange County, and the hearing was held on that afternoon, and after hearing for about an hour and a half of oral arguments from both sides, the judge declined to block Newsom's order and said a full hearing was needed before the courts would intervene in light of the public safety threat from COVID-19. So a hearing on that case is set for a week from today, next Monday, May 11th. And a side note, the court hearings are now being done by conference call.
Conference call. Okay, now speaking of openings, a very popular eatery in San Clemente opened its doors back up on Friday. What happened and where does this stand now?
Yeah, this is getting a lot of attention in Orange County today. This is Nomad's Canteen in San Clemente, a popular local spot. It opened back up over the weekend. The owners said that they had dozens of employees and their family members who rely on the business but have been going without the income. But meanwhile, the state order still has explicitly said that in-person dining is not allowed statewide. It's, again, one of the big topics of discussion today in Orange County. And over the weekend, there was a visit from county health officials and sheriff's deputies to the restaurant and bar. And apparently there was a warning issued that the restaurant's license was at risk. But the county's now apparently backing off of that. County officials apparently are going to rescind their threat against the license there. And Supervisor Don Wagner said today that he expects that to happen, and that the intent of the County Board of Supervisors when they issued business guidelines last week was that as long as social distancing is happening, that businesses could reopen, and as long as they followed other kind of health and safety guidelines. So a lot of interesting questions about enforcement and who will and won't be doing that.
Wondering, Nick, what's been the role of law enforcement in all this?
Yeah, so they're trying to thread a needle on this. What law enforcement officials have said, including Sheriff Don Barnes, is that they're trying to focus more on education over enforcement, and that by and large that works. They say that when sheriff's deputies walk up to people who may not be fully practicing social distancing and explain the health risks to people, the vast majority of people tend to honor that. They're concerned for their health and start to implement social distancing. But there's an interesting question, I think a legal debate going on right now at the county, of how much should they enforce the closure orders against restaurants and bars that may be reopening in-person dining. And that's still TBD and probably more to come tomorrow at the County Board of Supervisors meeting.
One more thing, just to provide a little context here. The biggest headlines out of Orange County right now are all about how people and officials are pushing back against the stay-at-home orders and breaking the rules, so to speak. But is this a fair picture of what's really happening, or are just a couple of loud voices getting all the attention?
It's a great question. It's really a mixture. The county has 3 million people, larger than, I think, 22 individual U.S. states. So there's a whole wide range of views in Orange County. There were hundreds of protesters, I think some estimates over 1,000, on Friday opposing the governor's orders. And they were certainly speaking to a frustration many people have and a restlessness from people who want to return back to business and see a relaxing of some of the stay-at-home orders. On the other side, we've also seen many residents want a more cautious approach to reopening, and that they're concerned that moving too fast will risk a further spread of the virus that could impact health workers. So there's a lot of different views on this. And at the end of the day, officials have said the vast majority of the 3 million people in Orange County have been very cooperative in complying with the public health orders.
That's Nick Gerda with the Voice of OC. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
All right, more Take Two coming up in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org. I'm A. Martinez. During the first week of government shutdown orders in mid-March, reporter Emily Guerin visited every small business on two blocks of Lincoln Boulevard in Venice. 6 weeks later, she checked in again to see how things had changed.
I picked Lincoln Boulevard because it had a little bit of everything. A tobacco shop, a fabric store, an artisanal ice cream parlor, a payday lender. The first time I went, it was March 16th, the day after L.A. Mayor Eric Garcetti closed down bars, gyms, movie theaters, and restaurant dining rooms. But for the next few days, at least, other businesses were allowed to stay open. There was, though, this impending sense of doom. Sam Wavin owns a frame shop, Frame 2000, and he was especially prescient about the likelihood that government aid would not get to many of the businesses that need it most.
Well, you know, like a small business loan, lots of us are not going to get approved, and we need the help right now, today.
It turned out he was right. The $349 billion federal paycheck protection program ran out of money after just 13 days. And as many journalists have reported, banks fast-tracked bigger loans for bigger companies, leaving the little guys out. Now when I visit Frame 2000, the door is closed, and they have a sign up saying, "We're just cleaning, we're not going anywhere." So I call, and store manager Will Hernandez answers. He says until recently, they were letting people pick up their framed pictures. But then he says the police showed up at their door and started writing a ticket.
But I cried so much, he ripped the paper and he gave me a warning.
After that, Frame 2000 closed completely, and Hernandez worries it might be for good.
The work that we do here is definitely is a luxury. I really don't think it is an essential. I mean, you picture frame, you can wait a year or years.
Frame 2000 isn't the only store on Lincoln that's been visited by the police. Back in March, Lincoln Tobacco Shop employee Danny Borgasani told me,
"If we're forced to shut down, then yeah, we're going to shut down. But until, like, the government steps in, we'll probably still be open."
Tobacco shops were ordered to close just 3 days later. But according to L.A. City Attorney Mike Feuer, Lincoln Tobacco Shop defied those orders. 2 weeks ago, Feuer announced he's filing criminal charges against the store. Laundromats and dry cleaners are considered essential businesses, though. Enrique Catalan owns Globe Cleaners, and in the past month, he's seen an uptick in his drop-off laundry service.
Going to a laundromat can be kind of risky, especially for a lot of the older population that is more at risk for COVID-19.
But it's not enough to make up for the steep decline in dry cleaning.
We've dropped about 70 to 80%.
Catalan used to have 5 employees. He now works alone.
You ladies ready?
Yes.
Victor, help these ladies.
Down the street, Fabric Planet is also allowed to stay open under the county's health order because it sells supplies for masks. And it is busy. Employees wearing masks stuff packages full of cotton and quarter-inch elastic to ship around the country. A woman with purple pigtails uses her unemployment benefits to buy fabric and scissors. Owner Jack Jacob Sapar tells me,
there's tons of people coming in like her. Designers that I know that they're just making masks now and they're able to make an income.
In March, Sapar was worried he'd have to lay people off. But now, he has four sewers making masks full-time. He sells them for anywhere from $0 to $11, whatever people can pay.
I mean, this mask thing has been a blessing in disguise, not just for us, for the entire industry, because you're seeing this surge of manufacturing in LA again, which is exciting.
But the mask boom doesn't make up for the huge drop in the higher-end custom sewing work that Sapar used to get, like making patterns for designers. He could only pay half his rent in April, and he says he'll probably do the same this month. Finally, I stopped by the 76 gas station. Back in March, owner Hadar Shimshi told me gas sales were down and hand sanitizer sales were up.
I actually bought some last week, and within 5 minutes, two customers came in back-to-back and bought all of them.
Now, gas sales have fallen off a cliff. But Shimshi says he is selling a lot more of something else, lottery scratch tickets. I'm Emily Guerin.
California is our home, but it's also a destination for travelers from all over the country and the world. And the tourism industry is one of the biggest employers in the state. A new report was released today by the nonprofit group Visit California, and it shows how much of an economic engine tourism normally is in the state, which begs the question, what's happening now? Joining us is Caroline Batetta, president and CEO of Visit California. Caroline, thanks for joining Take Two.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, what sectors really drive tourism in the state, and what's happened to these areas in the last 7 weeks?
Well, unfortunately, COVID has not been kind to the hospitality industry, not only here in California, but frankly around the world. And what we're seeing now after 10 record years of growth in tourism spending is we're rolling back about those 10 years. And just even since the end of May, we're projected to lose 613,000 jobs in hospitality by the end of May. And for the year, Oxford Tourism Economics is projecting we'll lose about $72 billion in spending, which is half of our overall tourism economy.
And we're not just talking about Disneyland, right, and theme parks. There's a lot that really drives tourism more than just theme parks.
Yes, we're so fortunate in California that every county gets some tourism spending. So whether it's Napa, Sonoma, our great wine tasting, our great cities, our 300-plus state national parks, Lake Tahoe, it's just the deserts. It's spread everywhere, our 840 miles of coastline. Tourism, the dollar touches every part of California.
Just for context, in the pre-pandemic era, how much money would tourism bring into California a year, every single year?
For 2019, it brought in $144 billion in spending.
Wow, so now that's a lot of money that's no longer in California's tourism wallet. Today, though, Governor Gavin Newsom announced that there'll be a move to phase two of reopening the state. So I'm wondering, Caroline, what could this possibly mean for the tourism industry?
Well, I certainly think hope is on the horizon, and really appreciate the governor's, you know, pragmatic approach and data-driven approach to this. I think at the end of the day, we do need to stay safe and practice protocols and keep safe our vulnerable population. So it's moving in the right direction. For now, leisure travel really isn't contemplated in that. You know, we're looking at, you know, soft openings of some limited restaurant and retail operations as we move into stage two. But it's moving in the right direction.
Right. Now, you mentioned protocols. What sort of protocols will tourism destinations such as maybe theme parks or museums consider putting in place?
I think what you'll see is similar to other business operations, or even when we go to the grocery store. There'll be a lot of use of PPEs. There could even be some thermal scanning for employers, social distancing, you know, places marked in a queue line, for example, of every 6 feet, and certainly a lot more rounds of cleaning protocols for high traffic and high touch places.
Yeah, I was thinking how a line at a theme park, Caroline, is already long to begin with, but it might actually literally be longer because we have to make it longer.
And thanks to the wonders of technology, I think the theme parks are contemplating how we can improve that, similar to, you know, fast pass or paging systems. They're great innovators, and I think we're going to see some pleasant surprises when the time is right.
Now, over the past week, we've seen some beach communities, namely in Orange County, protest the governor's order to close the beaches. Your organization, Visit California, has stakeholders really from all over the state. So what are you hearing from people in the tourism industry about reopening for business?
You know, the tourism industry wants to make sure we're not in a situation of two steps forward, one step back, because then it just delays the inevitable and makes it even more protracted. So the tourism industry is really heeding the calls of the governor and our public health officials to do it right so we don't end up on a roller coaster. And I think that's powerful considering we're in the mobility movement and encourage travel. We do want this done right so that we get it right the first time.
Yeah, I don't want to bring up like a worst case scenario, but yeah, let's just say everything starts moving and then we all have to take a step back, as you mentioned, tourism. That would be horrible because tourism requires planning and looking ahead on the calendar and making all these sort of arrangements.
Yes. Yeah, I'm glad you said that. That's even more so for destinations that are highly dependent on group business, that convention business, even weddings. Those are long-term plans that we do not want to make changes to.
One more thing, Caroline. How quickly might some areas of tourism rebound once we start all moving in that direction?
Well, I think the good news right now is sentiment is very reserved. We look at sentiment through the lens of the outbreak itself, the economic fallout, and just personal safety and security. And so that is tracking with this, you know, migration to each stage of opening, which is highly complementary. So, you know, as we see soft openings, it kind of tracks with where the sentiment is based on those filters I talked about. And I think that bodes all of us well for long-term success.
Caroline Batetta, President and CEO of Visit California. Caroline, thanks a lot.
Great, thanks.
All right, if you missed any part of Take Two today, boy, you missed a great show. Come on, it's on at 2 o'clock every day. You got to put it in your calendar or something. But if you want to find it, just go wherever you get your podcasts. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. We're also on social media at Take Two. I'm there as well at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.